thank you to our holding group, which we have organized this, and we continue to organize and want to have more and more of these assemblies of freedom. And that's what we are. We're all here to assemble for freedom. Just a few housekeeping items. There is only one exit, and that is the entrance that you came into. There are two bathrooms, one downstairs and one upstairs. And of course, as you were greeted to turn off your cell phone, that is for real. We want them not only on, they can't be on airplane mode, they need to be completely and totally off. The other thing is that when you leave, please do not turn on your cell phone. Turn it on when you're away from here so that we are not too visible. The parking exit, if you have a four-wheel drive vehicle, you can continue to go into the other exit as you go around past the house. But if you do not have a four-wheel drive vehicle, I do not recommend that you go that way. So just be patient when we exit. And of course, I know as you came to the door, Kristen was greeting you with the basket. We do appreciate contributions because we want to continue to do this in a more robust way even than now. This room is surrounded by windows. And captured in those windows are argon atoms, because that's how they're insulated. Argon is a curious thing. It actually is in the air and connects us all, both in the past and to the future. Argon, by the time you're 1 year old, you have breathed a breath of argon that every living being ever to be on this earth has breathed. That's every person who has ever walked and breathed and been here. And that's the dinosaurs and the raccoons and all of those things too. So it's interesting that the light comes into this room with these magnificent windows, and these windows have captured argon, the argon that has been on this earth since the beginning and then some. So the whole point of this is that we are gathering together unified because we are. We're all unified, no matter what you do and no matter what you believe. We know this. And yet, what is going on right now in this temporal moment is we are being asked not to come together. Look at this crowd. We are together. This is our freedom, and this is our right to assemble. So the point of all of this is to be informed, and that's what we want to be. And that's the reason why we have Dr. Tom Cowan and Dr. Andrew Kaufman here today to help us be more informed. But before we do that, what we also need to do is to be able to breathe even more of those argon atoms, and also to do something cultural that allows us to experience each other in a way that's not intellectual, in a way that is different, but at the same time, so deeply, deeply part of our ancestry and to who we are as human beings. And so I suggest, or we suggest, is that it's just a gift to be simple. It's just a gift to be free. Let's sing.
Tis a gift to be simple, tis a gift to be free, tis a gift to calm down where we ought to be. And when we find ourselves in a place just right, it will be in the valley of love and delight. When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend we shall be ashamed, to turn and to turn. delight, till by turning, turning, we come round right.
Thank you. Yes, sir. Yes, there is an exit and only one exit. And that exit is the door that you came into. So that is very important. And yes, to be reminded again is good. Yes, Dale.
There's another door, a flying door on this kitchen.
That's
awesome. Well, we didn't put an exit sign there. And so technically, as a place of assembly, which we kind of are not, there is only one exit here, and that is the exit door that you came in. It's very important that you understand that so that we do an orderly exit if we need to. And then somebody could usher you in another place. So anyway, without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Tom Cowan.
Biggest heroes were actually the Lone Ranger and Zorro. And so as time went on and I was too embarrassed and too blind to wear a mask because it doesn't fit over glasses. You know, one always has to look on the bright side of the idea about wearing masks. So I decided that for this introduction, because one of my things that I'm wondering about is whether I'm actually the Lone Ranger or Tonto. And I'm hoping to find that out. Tonto. Tonto. So that's enough of that. Thinking of giving it a try. Some years ago, I gave a talk, can everybody hear me okay?
Yeah.
Yes. To a group of Waldorf teacher trainees, I think it was. And I asked them, what is the goal of teaching children? What do you want from your children? What's the goal of, why are you going into being a teacher? Why are you parenting children? Why are you grandparenting children? And does anybody want to take a stab at it? I'm sure a lot of you are teachers, parents, grandparents. What's the goal? And you get one sentence or less. Yes.
To love.
To love. That's great. Anybody else?
To help them become truly who they are.
To help them become truly who they are. One more.
So that they can live their lives in freedom.
Lives in freedom. Those are all wonderful ideas. They were, however, not what I said, because I said I have been looking into what modern physics and physicists say about the world, and I think probably most of you know this. They say that matter, in other words, stuff, things in the world, exist either in two phases or two types. One is a particle, and one is a wave. And then furthermore, they say that the thing that determines whether a thing is a particle or a wave is whether you look at it or not. So in other words, the consciousness of the observer determines the physical reality. So when I heard that, I decided that for me, the goal of education, the goal of raising a child, the goal of being a parent, the goal of then now being a grandparent to six children is I want the children that I encounter to, as far as possible, see the world as a wave and not a particle. Because I also have a theory as a doctor, or was a doctor, that insofar as you see the world as a particle, you become sick. And insofar as you see the world as a wave, I also think, and I don't think I can prove this, but I think a very young child doesn't see the difference between things. They see the world, and the world is made of waves. And only if you put the word refrigerator under the refrigerator, you're essentially forcing them to see the world from the standpoint of particles. And insofar as you get more and more into life and you start seeing the world from the point of view of it's made of these individual particles rather than the mystery of waves, then I think you become sick. Now, the interesting thing about the whole idea of particles, because one of the things that we're going to be talking about a fair amount today is this particle called a virus. And then you think about, what is a particle, right? A wave is nothing. And we're told that physical matter is made out of nothing except energy flow. But even a particle, according to modern physics, it has a nucleus that's here, and let's say if it was this big, then the electrons circling it would be somewhere in Claverack or Philmont, or in the next room, or somewhere way far away, if it was to this scale, right? That's the modern conception of an atom. So the question is, it's gonna be hard for me to stay behind this thing, what's between here and Claverack? You know what the answer is?
Nothing.
Well, yeah, apple trees and roads. But from an atom point of view, absolutely nothing. So 99.9% of the stuff that we're made of, when it's not totally not stuff, right, waves, is actually nothing. Now, does anybody know and can explain in one word how stuff made out of nothing makes a table, or a foot, or a virus that we believe in? Because I've thought about this for a long time, and I don't think I know the answer to that. And in fact, I've probably asked hundreds, if not thousands, of people, and I'm not sure I've gotten a good answer. You know, I could give a stab at it, but I don't think I'll go into that right now. And I think we have to keep that in mind when we're talking about the illusion that is a virus. Because to a certain extent, that's not so different than this illusion that is a particle. But somehow we've been convinced that these particles, and by the way, when you go to medical school, and I don't know if there's any other doctors besides Bronco and Andy and I, you are told, and I would almost say harassed, into thinking that there is nothing else in the world but particles, period. If you dare to say that a human being is made out of energy flow or any other living being is some sort of energy, which is exactly what the physicists tell us, then you are a heretic to be eliminated from the tribe, because that just doesn't happen. So, I did actually, most people don't know this, but I did do an inadvertent 6 months of Waldorf teacher training in England. I won't go into that story. But one of the things I did learn, even though I didn't show up for most of the classes, but was that it's good to tell people what you're going to do or teach them or say or something in the beginning, and then they can see whether you actually did that. So, in other words, what are the goals for this day from my point of view? So, the first one, clearly, is to make you laugh. And I think, actually, I'm well on my way to that. The second one, clearly, is to make you either think to yourself or maybe say to the person next to you something like, this guy's kind of an idiot. I mean, that's an outrageous thing to say. It might even make you a little bit angry. And I'm not like a stranger to that. I don't necessarily worry about that. Because frankly, a lot of my friends and people I know think I say things that are a little bit crazy. And in fact, truth be told, I think if you ask my wife and some of my family members, they actually think I say some things that are a bit crazy. And in fact, the real truth be told is sometimes I think I say things that are a little crazy. So don't worry about it and just process it and think to yourself, what the heck is going on here? And then the final thing, which sometimes the most difficult, is to make you cry. Now, you can't really make anybody cry. And it could be crying out of, oh my God, I can't believe I sat through this for 6 hours. That's one way. Or it hopefully could be a cry of inspiration. Because if I did those three, then as far as I'm concerned, this was a success. So with that little bit long-winded introduction, we're talking about the first part. So there's I talk, and then Andy talks, and then I talk, and then we ask, and then we eat, and then we ask questions. The first part of this is the title is What Doesn't Make You Sick? And then the second part of my talk is hopefully will be actually what does make you sick. So the first part is what doesn't make you sick. So there's a long history of this, and one of the things that most people think makes you sick is contagious germs. Now, when we say contagious germs, one of the goals of the way I talk and the way I think is to be hopefully as clear in the wording as possible. I don't want anybody to misunderstand or not be very clear what I'm talking about. So when I'm talking about contagious germs, I mean germs, bacteria, and virus that spread from one person or one animal to one person to another, and are so-called pathogenic, meaning they make you sick. Now, the first thing I would say about this, and I do appreciate that some of you, maybe all of you, and most of you anyways, have probably heard some of this, so just bear with me, because there will be some new things, hopefully. But it's also to make this as clear as possible. So the idea that there are unseen things, right, particles, that make you sick, has been going on for a long time. People talked about this in Greek times. People talked about this for a long, long time. Because to a certain extent, it makes intuitive sense. You get sick, somebody else gets in the family, gets the same kind of sickness. You sort of see things like that. And so this was investigated for years and years. But interestingly, there are other ways of thinking besides sort of Western, quote, scientific ways of thinking. There's Chinese medicine, Chinese thinking, Ayurvedic, Indian, Native American, etc. And none of those thought that there were contagious germs that passed between people or animals and made them sick. None of them. There is no concept in homeopathic medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, Native American medicine of germs making people sick. Now, that doesn't mean it's not true. It's just interesting. That concept doesn't exist. And so people then started doing what are called epidemiological observations. And hopefully everybody knows what I mean by that. A lot of people in Wuhan got sick. A lot of people in Italy got sick. A lot of people on the cruise ship got sick. My Aunt Bessie went to a party and then she got sick or tested positive. Or on and on and on, there's hundreds of epidemiological observations, right? And if you ask most people, why do you think, how do you prove that these unseen germs make you sick, they say these epidemiological observations. Now, the problem is there is no scientist, no medical doctor, or real medical doctor, no virologist, no epidemiologist, nobody who does science who thinks you can prove viral or bacterial causation through epidemiology. Period. That's not how you do it. The only reason you do these kind of observations is to generate hypothesis that you can then test in a laboratory and find out what happened here. And so the reason I say that is I don't need anybody to give me more epidemiological observations to prove that such and such an illness is caused by a virus or bacteria. In fact, at this point, I've now agreed to agree that there is plenty of epidemiological observation to say that we should investigate whether there's a microbial cause to lots of diseases. So I don't need anybody to tell me anymore. We've got that. And in fact, we've had that for hundreds of years. And the problem is, there's many times, and one of the examples was something you probably heard about, which was in the 16, 17, 1800s, a lot of sailors on ships got sick, right? One after another. Their teeth fell out, they went into heart failure, they died. First one sailor, then another. For hundreds of years, they said, that must be a contagious something being passed between people because one after another people got sick. So it turns out that somebody eats a lemon or a lime and the whole thing gets better because that was scurvy. In other words, you cannot demonstrate viral microbial germ theory causation through using epidemiological observations. For hundreds of years, they thought pellagra, which killed millions, and beriberi, which killed millions, was a contagious germ that they couldn't see until they find out it was a B vitamin deficiency, and that's why millions of people died. And if you just soak your corn differently, the whole thing goes away. So anybody who says this epidemiological observation proves viral or bacterial causation is just scientifically illiterate. There's no other way to say it. That's not how any scientist does science. So with that background, it's a little weird there, but it's like fall over. I don't really like standing behind this thing anyways, but here we are. Because they say I can't, what?
You can push it hold forward.
I'll work it out in my own mind. So then we have this background, and then we come to the first, what I would call, eureka moment, right? So we got all these observations. There's something being passed from person to person. We can't see it. So they invent a light microscope, a microscope that you can see things smaller than you can see generally speaking. And they find these living things called bacteria in people who are sick, and at least sometimes not in the people who aren't sick. And one of the most famous examples, and now we're talking 1850s and we're talking Louis Pasteur, he said there's a huge problem with sheep dying of something called anthrax, which is an illness, and I'm not even sure what the symptoms of anthrax are. But they were dying and they didn't know the cause, and it was decimating the countryside. And so he looks into the fluids of the sheep and he finds this bacteria in some, not all, and says, aha, eureka, we found it. There's a bacteria that's coming into these sheep, and that's what's causing them to be sick. Never mind that they had started dipping them in a poison called arsenic, but let's not think about that. So it must be, not all of the sheep had this bacteria, but certainly most of them did. And then you would then next do the next logical step, which is to investigate the sheep who don't have this disease. And to their surprise, about 50% had the same bacteria. Anyways, let's forget about that, because maybe you're resistant to it, or you being the sheep. So now, here we have a situation where some of the sheep who got sick with this illness have the bacteria, and some of the sheep who don't have the illness also have the bacteria, but not all. So then they did the next logical thing, which is to they isolate the bacteria from the sick sheep, right? And they give that to healthy sheep by various routes, spray it up their nose, inject it in them, etc. And you know what happened? Nothing. They couldn't make a sick sheep sick from the isolated bacteria. Now, here's where, if there's any other thing besides laughing, crying, and thinking this guy's an idiot, that I want you to get out of this, is what in the heck do we mean by isolation? Because that is the key, and literally every day now, I get 10 emails from people saying, title of the paper, The Isolation of the Novel Coronavirus, right? I get 10 papers a day from people all over the place. So we need to know exactly what that word means and what it doesn't mean. Because Pasteur and his fellows did, in fact, isolate the bacteria and found out that it didn't cause disease. And then later, Koch, his German contemporary, formulated rules, which are common sense. If you have a disease, everybody with that disease should have the bacteria, right? That's common sense. If you say a fireman causes a fire, it would be nice to know that there's a fireman at the fire, yeah. Right? And then he said, and if you don't have the disease, if there's no fire, you shouldn't have firemen there. And then you isolate the firemen and see whether they actually caused the fires. And it turns out they couldn't prove it. Not once with bacteria. In fact, every time they did it, they failed. Now, interestingly, Pasteur did an experiment where he took 150 sheep and he separated them into 75 and 75. And he came up with an anthrax vaccine. Now, interesting, and we know this from his diary, he kept a personal diary so that people could realize what a turd he was. And he admitted in there that he couldn't make any of the sheep sick with the bacteria anthrax, but if he made, quote, virulent anthrax, which means he mixed it with some arsenic and some carbolic acid, etc., then he could kill the sheep. So he takes these 75 sheep who are vaccinated and he gives them the normal anthrax. And he gives the 75 unvaccinated sheep the virulent anthrax with the arsenic in it. All 75 sheep die. None of the 75 sheep in the vaccinated die, because he gave them regular anthrax, and that became modern vaccinology. That's the start right there. And he relayed this in his diary. So what do I mean by isolation? Because that's the key. So probably some of you have heard this. Imagine, and you have to very closely pay attention to wording here. My goal is to figure out whether caffeine in coffee beans gives people high blood pressure. Right? Everybody clear? So, I take coffee beans and I grind them up in a coffee grinder and I put it in a capsule and I give 10 people these capsules of ground up coffee beans. 10 people I give some inert sugar or something. And all 10 in the coffee bean have a high blood pressure. None of the 10 in the inert have high blood pressure. Have I now proven that the caffeine in the coffee beans cause high blood pressure? Anybody says yes? No. because, I don't know why, you read my book. Or because you can think. That's not what isolation means, right? So, let's take it a step further. Let's take the coffee that we ground, because we're making coffee, and we put it through a filter paper, and we get rid of the ground part, and now we have coffee. And we do the same thing, do a placebo, 10 with water, 10 with coffee, all 10 get high blood pressure. Have I now proven that the coffee, the caffeine in the coffee makes high blood pressure? No. Anybody disagree? No, because that would be silly. Because there's more things in there than just caffeine, right? So how about if I do some sort of chemical flow cytometry or centrifugation, and I take out just the caffeine. I know how to use a chemical magnet. I pull up, because anything that's a thing, this is a thing made of particles. You can isolate it. Here it is. Anything that's a thing, you can count it. There's three forks. If you put this, those are not isolated forks. When the CDC says we have no quantitative isolates of the novel coronavirus, that means they've never seen the fork. And that's why they can't see it and they can't count it, because it's not there. Now, let's back up a little bit. So, where was I? Oh, coffee. So, you take the caffeine, you prove, right, by sending it to a lab, they say all you got there is caffeine. You prove it, and then somebody does your exact procedure, right? They do the same steps, because in your paper, if you're going to get published, you have to describe exactly what your steps are. I put it in a coffee grinder, I put it through a filter paper, it has this big of mesh, something like that. I centrifuged it at 600,000 RPMs per minute, it comes out in a band, I suck the band out, I show on a picture or an independent lab, that's all there is caffeine. I give that to 10 people, I give them an inert chemical on the side, all 10 people have high blood pressure. Have I now proven it? Everybody said, raise your hand if you think yes. I think yes. Pretty darn good. You've isolated the caffeine, you did a proper control, and everybody got high blood pressure. You could say you need to do 1,000 people or whatever. But that is how you do science. You demonstrate how you do it, and then you prove that that's all you've got. So, getting back to this, they did this with bacteria, all kinds of them. And then, interestingly, Koch, who came up with these principles, if the disease is caused by a bacteria, the bacteria should be there. If you don't have the disease, there shouldn't be. Because, by the way, these people, believe it or not, thought that there are no bacteria in us from here on in. And that any bacteria in us from here on in was a pathogen coming from the outside. And these are the philosophical foundations of why we practice medicine the way we do. And that is laughable to any modern person. Nobody thinks that, but they did. So they can't prove it, and then they come to a fork in the road, and they could say, this thing doesn't work. These germs, these bacteria are not there as pathogens. Or they could do what they did, is change the rules. So now we have different logic. I don't even know that I want to describe what the logic is. But one could also ask, so what are those bacteria doing there? right? I'm not saying, me, that there are no bacteria in your throat when you have strep throat. I'm not saying there aren't anthrax bacilli in your tissues if you have the disease anthrax. What I'm saying is, if you isolate them and do proper science, you cannot show that they cause disease, like it or not. And I tell you, when I started learning about this, one of the questions that was so interesting to me is, why do these people even care? Like, I don't care whether they cause disease or not. Like, it's no skin off my nose. If they do, they do, and you kill them. If they don't, you don't, and then you have to find out what they're doing there and what did cause it. The thing is, if you look out into nature, you know, if you have a compost pile, a lot of you are probably gardeners, and you put dead squirrels on your compost pile, you'll get funky bacteria to biodegrade and recycle the squirrels. Nobody thinks your compost pile has an infection. And nobody thinks if you took those bacteria from your compost pile that ate the dead squirrels and put them into a healthy compost pile, they don't grow. They're there to biodegrade and recycle the stuff that you shouldn't have put in. The role of bacteria in nature is to recycle that which is dead and dying. That's why they're there in your throat, because there's something wrong with your throat. Now, I'm going to get into the second part, which, what does make your throat sick? It's the same with algae in a pond. If you have a pond, and it's a healthy pond, you don't get sort of toxic algae. And then you put stuff in your pond that shouldn't be there, and you get all kinds of fungus and bacteria to do what? To recycle those things that shouldn't be there, that don't belong. And imagine the world without those fungus and bacteria to recycle that which is dead and dying, and we would all be dead. Imagine you cut down a tree in the forest and there's no bacteria and fungus to recycle that into humus. And I don't know why there's any reason to think we're somehow not part of nature, except that is what we were taught in medical school. You're not part of nature. There is nothing about what you can look out and observe and see for yourself in nature that has any relevance to what goes on in your body. And I don't know that anybody has actually proven that, because I don't actually think it's true. The role of bacteria, and it doesn't mean they don't make pain, and it doesn't mean that if there's a whole lot of toxicity and dead stuff that they're eating, that you might not be able to mitigate the symptoms by killing them. But the whole history of the medicine from Hippocrates saying, give me a medicine to produce a fever and I can cure any disease, a fever / bacteria to do their agents of bioremediation. This is exactly what you see, and any culture that has a war on bacteria as the recyclers in nature will end up being a chronically sick, building up poisons, cancer-ridden culture. No exceptions, because that's how it works in nature. So then we move on, and we say, not we, them, say, okay, so we know about anthrax and strep throat, we can see the bacteria. There are other diseases that we don't see anything in our microscope, yet we know, because that's our theory. So medicine and science nowadays has become, we believe in the theory, and then we go looking for evidence to support it, not the other way around. So we believe there are things that are causing these other diseases that we just don't have the power to see them under the microscope. But they must be there. And so they call them viruses, for the old Latin word meaning poison. And so one of the most prominent examples was a disease that had started in the late 1800s. There's essentially no evidence of this before that, called polio. Now, never mind that the pathology or the site of the body that's injured with polio is called the anterior horn cells, part of the nervous system, and that lead arsenic, which was used to basically kill moths, I think, was started to be used at exactly the time and place that they started to see polio. And the part of the body that the polio, sorry, that the lead arsenic affects turns out to be the anterior horn cells of your spinal cord. An interesting coincidence. So they take the anterior, children or people who died of polio, and they say there must be something which we can't see because we don't have the microscopic power to see it. And they say, we're going to demonstrate that this thing we can't see is contagious and a pathogen. Which is interesting, because if you can't see it, it's a little bit hard. But anyway, so they take people who died of polio or people who were paralyzed, and they ground up their brains or their spinal cord, just like the coffee grinder, right? This is not so esoteric that any normal person can't understand exactly what is going on here. It's not. They have you thinking you can't understand it. You can totally, perfectly understand it. They take ground up diseased spinal cord and they put it through a filter to get rid of the tissue and the debris and the bacteria and the fungus. And then they expose a number of different animals to this. Now, raise your hand to anybody who thinks there is any possibility you could prove that was a virus. Nobody. Because that's the coffee. There's a lot of things in there. You don't know if there's arsenic in their spine. You don't know why the person died. That's why we're doing this experiment. So the person died, they or had paralysis, they ground up the brain, they filter it, and then they exposed about 20 different animals to this filtrate, the supernatant, right? You know what happened? And now this isn't even purified. This is just brain goop that's the liquid part, and some of the debris is gone, and none of the animals got sick. They tried it orally, they tried it spraying it up their nose, they injected it. None of the animals got sick. And then they came to an interesting conclusion, which you should pay attention to the words here. They said, that's because, and it actually says this in Wikipedia. If you go to Wikipedia and polio, because Wikipedia, as we all know, is 100% accurate, right? So it must be true. It says, the reason for this and the scientific brilliance of discovering the polio virus was the cause of polio is the fact that there are no animal models for polio. Now, again, this is all about understanding wording. So you take the goop, which is not purified, it's stuff, and you can't expose people to that because that's unethical, right? So you don't know if it makes people sick. So you take 20 different animals, rats, mice, hamsters, baboons, chimpanzees, and all of them you expose to different ways, to the same goop. None of them get sick. And you could conclude one of two things. One, this is nonsense. It doesn't make anybody sick. Or two, this is because there's no animal model for polio. In which case, how would you know that it makes anybody sick? You don't have any information about people. You don't have any information about animals. You are stuck. And so they got out of it with a study in 1907, which I don't remember who did it, who took the goop from filtered diseased spine of a child who had polio, did a biopsy, takes the goop, macerated it in a blender, filtered it, injected it into two monkeys by drilling a hole in their brain, injected about a half a cup of each of unfiltered stuff in their brain, didn't do a control, like they didn't inject saline or cottage cheese or milk or anything, turpentine, nothing. They just did that. One of the monkeys died. The other got paralyzed. They hold the monkey up by the scruff of the neck, say, see, we proved polio is contagious. And you read that and you think, what the heck? Like, that's nuts. Anyways, so they go on like that, trying to do the same thing and not having animal models. And I have a friend who's doing the whole thing with yellow fever and all these viral diseases. Same thing. We can't purify it. We can't isolate it. We don't know what's in there. We take we take filtered goop, coffee, and can't find an animal model, but we know that it causes disease. And then comes the second. What time am I supposed to? 2:15.
We have another 20 minutes.
We're good. So we get to the second eureka moment, right? You with me? Here's where we're at. Where they invent the electron microscope. Electron microscope. So what does that do? The problem is saying, I know there's only caffeine. You have to have some laboratory mechanism of saying that's all you've got. And until the electron microscope, you couldn't see the viruses, so they didn't know whether they purified it or isolated it or not. So then in the mid to early 30s, they develop an electron microscope. They can take the polio people, they can, or chickenpox or herpes or anything that we think is a viral disease. And you can do this coffee steps. You can grind it up, you can filter it, you can put it through a centrifuge, it comes out in a band, you can pipette it out. You can look at it under an electron microscope. You can show people that all you've got is this virus. Right? All you've got is this virus. They're uniform, identical particles. And so you have now demonstrated that you have isolated and purified the virus. That doesn't prove it's causing anything, right? We know just because you can get caffeine out of coffee beans doesn't prove that it causes high blood pressure. So you do the same thing. You expose a bunch of different animals, you inject it, etc. You don't do it on humans because that's unethical. None got sick. So as Stefan Lenka, who probably knows more about this maybe than anybody, says, the virologists disproved virology. And they were all going to go home and be plumbers, except plumbing doesn't pay as much. So they decided that they have to carry on with this because they couldn't demonstrate it once they learned how to isolate, purify, check their work. Like third grade, you have to check your work and see if the picture is only virus. Otherwise, you don't know what you're testing. So they expose that to animals, they get nothing. Okay, this is nothing in here, let's go home. And some guy named Embers gets a Nobel Prize for rescuing virology. Here's what he did. He was working, I think, with measles. So he takes the exudate from somebody with measles and he filters it, just like, you know, the coffee example. And that's it. So we have unpurified stuff. And then he inoculates that on a tissue culture. What is that? That means they take living tissue from a monkey or a cow or a fetus or an egg yolk or some different living thing, living tissue, because viruses don't grow in culture medium, right? They don't grow, they're not living, they're particles. We know about particles. If you believe in particles, you get sick. Any two-year-old child knows that. They believed in these particles. They say they make you sick. So they said they didn't find the particles. They used this, and they don't grow on their own. They can't show that you get, if you put the goop with the particles in it, you put it in a culture medium like a broth, you don't get more particles. So you have to inoculate that onto tissue, living stuff. So they do that. They take kidney cells, they inoculate the unpurified goop onto tissue, a monkey kidney tissue, and anybody guess what happens?
You get more.
You get more. Is that right? No. You get nothing. Because it doesn't grow on monkey kidney tissue. It doesn't grow on any tissue. Zip. And he got the Nobel Prize for discovering how to make it grow on monkey kidney tissue. You know how he did it? He took the monkey kidney tissue and he put it in minimal nutrient medium, i.e. starved it, right? And if you just grow it in normal food medium, like, you know, most tissue cultures have actually read Nourishing Traditions Diet, so they know what they need to be healthy and flourishing tissue, and then you take away and you give them pasteurized skim milk. And it's then you inoculate the stuff, and you know what happens then? Nothing. So then you say, well, we have to make sure there's no bacteria or fungus in this medium, so we're going to add gentamicin and amphotericin, otherwise known as amphoterrible, to the mixture. And anybody want to guess what specific toxicity gentamicin and amphoterrible have in humans and other animals?
Nephrotoxicity.
That means they're poisonous to the kidneys. And so what happens to the kidney tissue with this unpurified, inoculated stuff that you've now starved and poisoned? It breaks down into lots of little particles, lots of different kinds. Some of them have some relation. If there was an original particle, they have some relation to that. We'll get into that in a little bit later, why that might happen. That is how you prove that the virus in the original tissue is cytopathogenic, meaning it kills us. Meaning, really means kills tissue or cells. But it's pathogenic, disease-causing to tissue. By doing that, and he got a Nobel Prize for discovering how to propagate viruses. And that's it. And every single paper that you read now that I am sent that says we have isolated and purified and characterized the virus, still to this day does the exact same thing. They take unpurified stuff, they put it in a medium, they transport it, they inoculate starved and gentamicin, neomycin, penicillin, amphotericin onto the tissue breaks down. That proves the virus kills the tissue, which is why we know it's a pathogen. We can't show that it affects humans, we can't show that it affects any animal purified. We can only show that unpurified stuff, when starved and poisoned, causes the death of this tissue. And then they have the audacity to show you a picture of the stuff that comes out of there, which is not the same as what I showed you. I have pictures of it here, which has all kinds of stuff, you know, broken down tissue. Right? Because you poisoned the tissue. And so there you have broken down tissue, and then there's an arrow saying that's the coronavirus. And then we took this stuff and we do a PCR test to find out what genetic material is in the coronavirus, which we've never seen. And we say that it's got this segment in it. This sequence. Now ask yourself, if you have this three forks, a spoon, and a knife, and they're all made of the same thing, more or less, because the viruses are made of the same genetic material as the tissue is. And if you use humans, now here's where it gets interesting, and this may be one of the, I think this guy may be a little nuts. It turns out, according to Carrie Mullis, who invented the PCR test, and Barbara McClintock, who was given a Nobel Prize in 1993 for showing that the genetic material, the DNA in us, is more or less infinitely malleable. In other words, it's not fixed. And Carrie Mullis said, we have all the genetic segments in us that exist in the universe. Therefore, there is no test for a unique segment coming from a virus, because if you're using a human epithelial cell, every single piece of genetic material is in that brew, because it's flexible. And this idea that it's fixed is just what they call in Yiddish a bubamaisa, which means it's not true. Now, here's the interesting thing. What does that mean? If we have all of the possible genetic sequences in us, and we can change it and make whatever we want and we need, there are no genetic diseases. Wait a minute. It's like Chris Rock. You know how he says, there, I said it. There is no possibility. If you have all the sequences and you can make what you need, and in the second part I'll describe, I think, exactly how you make what you need, because you can change your DNA and make what you need, there is no possibility of finding a unique sequence to a virus. Because, like they found, the Roche PCR test, that sequence exists on human chromosome number 8. So they're testing for a genetic sequence found in human beings. So the PCR test does not have false negatives or false positives. That is a bubamaisa. The PCR test is looking to see whether you're a human or a papaya or a goat. Or a sheep, because those also test positive. It's also a kind of definition of the human being is created in the image of God. God is everything, right? All the genetic sequences. So is the human being. You are infinite in what you can create and in your malleability. That's what that proves. So the next question is, what are those particles doing there, right? You starve and poison the tissue, it makes particles, you can see them. What are they doing there? So we now know that one of the things they're doing there is they are, as I said in my original video, if you starve and poison, because that's how, ironically, we get sick too. Right? You starve and poison us, just like the viral cultures, which are not viral cultures. That is a oxymoron. I think that's the word. And that turns out how we get sick too. So what happens? You starve and poison a person, they make these packages of genetic material to poop out the poisons. And that helps them to detoxify. These are mineralized, broken down genetic materials. The only reason why some people have a higher so-called viral load or PCR test is because they're breaking down more. So if you have somebody who's breaking down more, they have more of these particles. What are they doing there? Primarily, they are detoxification, let's package up this stuff which we don't want because it's poisoning us, we excrete it, and then we use this particle, which is has this genetic material called DNA or RNA in it, which is a resonance antenna. How do I know that? Because it turns out you can do an experiment where you put a piece of DNA in a water beaker in one part of the room, has to be in water, and I'll tell you why this happened later, and then you put another part of the room over there, another beaker with water, with just stuff to make DNA out of, you know, nucleotides. And then you shine some energy source, like far infrared light, on the first one with the with the DNA sequence, and then you come back the next day, and the second beaker has an identical sequence. In other words, there's two purposes of this excretion of these particles. One is a detoxification method. The other is a resonance signal to all your friends, which is everybody, believe it or not, that there is something that's destroying my tissue. We better pay attention to this, maybe even make a defensive response. It's a communication strategy because, and like I said, I'm going to alert you to when you might shake your head, because this idea of natural selection based on mutations is complete nonsense. Because think about it. Imagine that in order to get a new genetic sequence to make a protein so you could make an effect, just like trees do. You have beetles eating a tree, they put out chemicals through the roots. This tells the other trees, there's something that happened here, you should make a defensive response. Because there is no survival of the fittest with trees, the trees, they read our book, they realize that they're all in this together, because if there's only one tree left, then it can't hang on to the water, and its sun is too hot, and that's not a fun way to live. So they live in community, like us. And you cannot live except in community, like us. And so we send out these resonance signals, because, let me back up. So if it was certain mutations, so imagine you have exposure to glyphosate, and one person, this is how we're told in medical school, one person has a mutation that allows them to get rid of the glyphosate. The theory is that person's progeny will have a selective advantage, and eventually everybody in the world will have this genetic mutation, right? That's how we're told. So what if it happens to be a postmenopausal woman? What if it happens to be somebody who had a Gardasil shot and then becomes infertile? What if it's somebody who chooses not to have children? Then what, the whole thing falls apart? And anyways, how long do you think it would take before, if you had a genetic mutation, everybody in New York State would be your prodigy? Progeny. Prodigal progeny. Progeny prodigal. Right? 1,000 years. By that time, there's dicamba instead of glyphosate. You don't need an enzyme for getting rid of glyphosate. The whole thing is nonsense. It can't work like that. So nature has a rapid response communication system called viruses, called exosomes, called packages of particles, sends them out, says you need this sequence, because we have all of them anyways, because there's no possibility of genetic diseases. And you package them up, you send them out, you make a new sequence, and you have a rapid evolution and a rapid adaptation to life. Without this process, we have no possibility of adapting to life. A war on these particles called viruses is a war on our ability to adapt to life, period. That's how it works. So, I think I can stop there. I have other things here. I can't stop there. Take a little break.
Just a little housekeeping.
Housekeeping.
Housekeeping. Because we're so jammed in, when you get up to take a little break, you need to put whatever you've got on the floor onto your chair. This is a very tight space. And we're just going to do a quick break. So 10, 12 minutes, and then we'll all come back for handicap. Thank you.